You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s. And Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts, hidden gems, and variety that you won't hear on generic classic rock stations. So tune in to The Roots of Rock and Roll, Fridays at 3 p.m. on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Democratic Socialist Zoran Mondani's victory speech in yesterday's mayoral primary in New York City. Also, farm workers resisting fascism and illegal arrest in the fields of misery. We'll speak to activist radical photographer David Bacon. He's been out there checking it out. And Flashpoints special Washington correspondent ignored by U.N. spokesperson re-war Israeli crimes, and that's Israeli war crimes, and what about attacking Iran? What is the world saying about that? All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. By the way, our Flashpoints theme was created for this show by Charles Lang, who's a marvelous singer, songwriter, artist, visionary, old friend, whose music keeps me going all the time. So we thank him for that contribution to Flashpoints, which you are listening to on Pacifica Radio. This is Free Speech Radio, Truth to Power, No Holds Barred. Yes, non-corporate. We've been doing this since 1949, and we're proud to continue. We're going to start off with a very powerful victory speech by Zoran Mamdani. He is the Democratic choice for mayor of New York City, and he hasn't won outright yet. They have a very interesting new ranked choice process. It's extraordinary, but it does look like a Democratic Socialist is in the lead, and he's an interesting guy. And so I thought it might be interesting to listen to his acceptance speech he gave yesterday. This is somebody who is willing to jump into the Hudson River with a full suit and tie to make a very important point. Anyway, listen to this. This is from yesterday.
Tonight,
lower your phones.
We made history. In the words of Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it is done. My friends, we have done it. I will be your Democratic nominee for the mayor of New York City. I spoke with Andrew Cuomo about the need to bring this city together as he called me to concede the race. And I want to thank Brad Lander. Together we have shown the power of the politics of the future. One of partnership and of sincerity.
Let's go. Let's go. There we go.
Today, 8 months after launching this campaign, with the vision of a city that every New Yorker could afford. That's right. We have won. We have won from Harlem to Bay Ridge. We have won from Jackson Heights to Port Richmond. We have won from Maspeth to Chinatown. We have won because New Yorkers have stood up for a city they can afford. A city where they can do more than just struggle. One where those who toil in the night can enjoy the fruits of their labor in the day. Where hard work is repaid with a stable life. Where 8 hours on the factory floor or behind the wheel of a cab is enough to pay the mortgage. It is enough to keep the lights on. It is enough to send your kid to school. Where rent-stabilized apartments are actually stabilized. Where buses are fast and free. Where childcare doesn't cost more than CUNY. And where public safety keeps us truly safe. And it's where the mayor will use their power to reject Donald Trump's fascism. To stop mass ICE agents from deporting our neighbors. To govern our city as a model for the Democratic Party. A party where we fight for working people with no apology. A life of dignity should not be reserved for a fortunate few. It should be one that city government guarantees for each and every New Yorker. If this campaign has demonstrated anything to the world, it is that our dreams can become reality. Dreaming demands hope. And when I think of hope, I think of the unprecedented coalition of New Yorkers that we have built. For this is not my victory. This is ours. It is the victory of the Bangladeshi auntie who knocked on door after door until her feet throbbed and her knuckles ached. It is the victory of the 18-year-old who voted in their first ever election. And it is the victory of the Gambian uncle who finally saw himself and his struggle in a campaign for the city that he calls home. Yeah. Dreaming demands solidarity. And when I look out at this room and out onto the midnight skyline, that is what I see. Canvas launches that continued in the pouring rain. Yeah. children who called parents, strangers who care about those they will never meet, a New York that believes in each other and in itself.
Yes.
This is solidarity.
Yes.
And it defines our victory. And above all, dreaming demands work. Last Friday night, as the sun began to drop in the sky, I set off on a 13-mile walk from the northernmost tip of Manhattan to the base of the island.
Yeah!
We began in Inwood, where music played and neighbors set out dominoes on the sidewalk. It was 7 p.m. The weekend had arrived. For most people, the time for work was over. But this is New York, where the work never ends. Waiters carried plates on 181st Street. Conductors drove the subways that rattled high above 125th. And world-class musicians tuned instruments as we passed Lincoln Square. By the time we made it downtown, a crowd marched behind us, a living embodiment of the energy and purpose that defines this campaign. Still, long past midnight, New York worked. Garbage trucks weaved through empty streets. Fishmongers carried in tomorrow's wares. And when we finally arrived at the Battery at 2:20 a.m. in the morning, the workers who run the Staten Island Ferry were on the job too. The day, every day of the week. Each of these New Yorkers carried a dream with them that night as they labored. Just as each of us dreams of a New York that is more hopeful and affordable for all. And we have worked hard for our dream. This has been a historically contentious race. One that has filled our airwaves with millions in smears and slander. I hope now that this primary has come to an end. I can introduce myself once more. Not as you've seen me in a 30-second ad or in a mail you're in your mailbox, but as how I will lead as your mayor. I will be the mayor for every New York. Whether you voted for me, for Governor Cuomo, or felt too disillusioned by a long, broken political system to vote at all, I will fight for a city that works for you, that is affordable for you, that is safe for you. I will work to be a mayor you will be proud to call your own. I cannot promise that you will always agree with me, but I will never hide from you. If you are hurting, I will try to heal. If you feel misunderstood, I will strive to understand. Your concerns will always be mine, and I will put your hopes before my own. And I know that those hopes extend beyond our five boroughs. There are millions of New Yorkers who have strong feelings about what happens overseas.
Yes.
I am one of them. And while I will not abandon my beliefs or my commitments, grounded in a demand for equality, for humanity, for all those who walk this earth, you have my word to reach further, to understand the perspectives of those with whom I disagree, and to wrestle deeply with those disagreements. Let me close with this. In these dark times, I know that it is harder than ever to keep faith in our democracy. It has been attacked by billionaires and their big spending, by elected officials who care more about self-enrichment than the public trust, and by authoritarian leaders who rule through fear. But above all, our democracy has been attacked from within. For too long, New Yorkers have strained to find a leader who represents us, who puts us first. And we have been betrayed time and again. After so many disappointments, the heart hardens. Belief becomes elusive. And when we no longer believe in our democracy, it only becomes easier for people like Donald Trump to convince us of his worth. For billionaires to convince us that they must always lead. As FDR said, democracy has disappeared in several other great nations. Not because the people disliked democracy, but because they had grown tired of unemployment and insecurity, of seeing their children hungry while they sat helpless in the face of government confusion and weakness. In desperation, they chose to sacrifice liberty in the hope of getting something to eat. New York, if we have made one thing clear over these past months, it is that we need not choose between the two. We can be free, and we can be fed. We can demand what we deserve. And together we have built a movement where everyday New Yorkers recognize themselves in our vision of democracy. Every new voter registered, that is faith renewed. Every voter who traveled through withering heat to the polls, that is faith renewed. And every New Yorker who sees solutions to the daily challenges they face in this campaign, that is faith renewed. Together, New York, we have renewed our democracy. We have given our city permission to believe again. And I pledge to you that we will remake this great city, not in my image, but in the image of every New Yorker who has only known struggle. In our New York, the power belongs to the people.
And that was Zoran Mamdani. He won the Democratic primary in New York City. He's the representative from the Democratic Party. He's, of course, got a very good shot at becoming mayor of New York City. He's 32 years old. He's an extraordinary human being by all accounts. Not making any decisions. I just am glad that the hack Democrats on the East Coast, Schumer in New York City, didn't have their way and get Andrew Cuomo, who clearly was a hack and has a reputation as sort of a woman grabber. And that was really troubling. And the Democratic Party did, in some way, with some strong support, go for him. So this is an amazing situation. We'll see how that turns out. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to focus a little bit on what's been happening at the UN with our special correspondent there. Then we're going to spend the second half of the show dealing with what's been going on in the fields of misery with farm workers, and also what's been going on in terms of organizing and the farm workers trying to fight back and hold their own. These are very terrible times. Stay with us. to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, our special Washington correspondent, Sam Husseini, who has been covering intensively the expanding genocide in Gaza and various aspects of it. He's been focusing lately also on the U.S. Israeli war against Iran. He was at the United Nations recently after the U.S. attack on the four nuclear structures, or whatever you want to call them, in Iran. And he was trying to get a response from the spokesperson from the United Nations about the, information about condemnation of the attacks in a structural way. And also he wanted to know why it wasn't being treated as a war crime and as an attempt to distract the United Nations from considering, as they were at the moment, a peace treaty with sanctions against Israel. Did Sam Husseini wanted to know, did Israel go to war in part with the United States to distract from the slaughter in Gaza? Listen to this.
Let me start with, I guess, the topic of the day. You saw that we issued a statement late last night on the escalation in the Middle East. The Secretary General condemns any military escalation in the Middle East. He's particularly concerned by Israeli attacks on nuclear installations in Iran, while talks between Iran and the United States on the status of Iran's nuclear program are underway. The Secretary General recalls the obligation of UN member states to act in accordance with the UN Charter and international law. The Secretary General asks both sides to show maximum restraint, avoiding at all costs a descent into deeper conflict, a situation that the region can hardly afford. Yes, go ahead.
The statement talks about the Iranian nuclear facilities. It doesn't indicate any other. Civilians were killed here. Officials were killed here. It wasn't simply the nuclear facilities. Isn't that a remarkable omission?
No. As I said, that statement was issued last night. We continue to follow with deep concern the evolving situation. And again, we continue to condemn any military escalation between the two parties.
Of course, the attack happened about 3 hours after the UN General Assembly passed a resolution yesterday, overwhelmingly 149 countries demanding that Israel lift the siege of Gaza, have a ceasefire, instructing member states to take all necessary measures to ensure Israel's compliance with international law. What is the Secretary General's plan for implementing this resolution?
So on this, again, the General Assembly vote yesterday showed a big support for a call to a full ceasefire, to unlimited to unfettered access for humanitarian assistance for Gaza. And the SG continues to call for the implementation of that resolution. The position has been expressed and re-expressed here by us, by the Secretary General himself, by everyone, that we continue to call for the implementation, for a full ceasefire to be achieved, for really humanitarian assistance. Day in, day out, we describe an intolerable situation that people in Gaza have to endure every day. We continue to call for really unfettered access to provide humanitarian assistance, and also for the release of all the hostages. And we continue to call for that. The General Assembly vote yesterday sends a clear signal that the world supports that all of those who voted in favor support that call, and we continue to hope that this is what will happen very soon.
So this is the Secretary General's plan to hope if Israel 3 hours later bombs Iran, and I ask you your plan, and you tell me the Secretary General hopes.
don't misconstrue these words.
The Secretary General, I'm not misconstruing anything. I'm repeating your words to you. The call for the ceasefire, the call for humanitarian assistance,
the call for the release of hostages has been issued loud and clear on numerous occasions, and the Secretary General and everyone that works here in New York on the ground continue to work day in, day out to try to push towards that, and we continue to call on all those who have influence over the parties to continue to push in that direction as well. All right, Deji.
Stephanie, wish you and all of us a peaceful and quiet weekend.
Don't we hope for that?
Good luck.
All right, thank you so much.
Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are turning our attention back to the situation regarding the expanding sweeps that the current administration is carrying out against brown people, some of the folks who do the hardest work in this country that we all depend on are under attack, being brutalized by this administration. And we've been trying to keep track of it. We are really honored. We have a special way to get into it today. And joining myself and Miguel Gavilán Molina is radical photographer David Bacon, who has spent many, many hours in the fields talking to the folks who do this work, who are now under attack. David, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Would you take a moment to talk a little bit about your beat in terms of photography, where you've been with that camera, and then tell us what you've been doing lately. You've got a couple of pieces out that are extremely relevant to this struggle that we're watching in the fields with this new administration in power.
Well, Dennis, thank you for having me on, and hi there, Miguel. Late in the last few months, I've spent time especially in Santa Maria, Oxnard, Salinas, along the coast, talking to strawberry workers and the organizations that are active in the communities of strawberry workers, organizations like the Mixteco Indigenous Community Organizing Project in Oxnard and Santa Maria, CAUSA, another community organization in Santa Maria and Oxnard, and talking to workers themselves. These organizations have, first of all, I want to give them credit. They have some brilliant organizers, and their work, I think, has been really crucial in helping people to organize to protect themselves from these terror raids that the Trump administration has been carrying out. So to talk a little bit about what they're doing, and this is not true. This is true not just for these communities, but I think we're seeing this all over the country, really. And that is that in immigrant communities, they are conducting what are called Know Your Rights trainings. And what they do is they basically help people to understand, for instance, basic rights, like you don't have to open your door to an ICE agent unless they can slip a judicial warrant signed by a judge with your name on it under the door. What that's really meant in Santa Maria, for instance, is that people stopped opening their doors to ICE agents. The ICE agents didn't go away. The terror campaign was still there, but people, you know, didn't open their doors. The ICE agents then would park their vans in communities in farm worker neighborhoods and wait for people to start to go to work and then try to stop them on the street and pick them up. This is what we saw when ICE agents back in February and March stopped Lilo Alfredo Juarez up in Washington State, a farm worker leader in Washington State who was stopped on his way where he was targeted. They knew who he was, and they followed him from his home to work and stopped him on the way. So this is basic self-protection kind of things. And it's gone along with some other efforts that started, I think, Union de Barrio in Los Angeles and San Diego. Maybe they were certainly one of the organizations that started, and that was this idea that they sort of track the ICE vehicles when they would leave their the place where, you know, they would park overnight, and they would track them into farm worker communities or into immigrant communities, and then get on the bullhorn and tell people in apartment houses and neighborhoods, don't open your doors, the ICE agents are here. This is something that I think has really enraged the Trump administration. In fact, I think that, plus remember what happened in Los Angeles at the garment shop and then over in Paramount, where ICE agents started conducting raids on workplaces and on the Home Depot, and people came out. David Huerta, the head of the janitors union in California, was there in downtown LA observing what was going on, and was then thrown to the ground and arrested, and had federal charges pressed against him now for the crime of basically observing and trying to sort of do what the Panthers did back in the day when they would hold logbooks and they would follow the Oakland police around and say, we're watching you, we know what our rights are, and we're going to make sure that everybody else does too. I think that's a big reason why we saw, you know, the 2,000 National Guards troops and the Marines, you know, called into Los Angeles. This is the Trump administration saying, if you try and interfere with our raids, this is our answer to you. I think it's really a testament to the bravery and courage of immigrant rights activists and workers and, you know, neighborhood residents and immigrants themselves that has stood up to this terror campaign. And it is something that is certainly very scary, Dennis. It is very frightening to people.
Yes, it's very scary. Another thing that we were talking about earlier off air that was very moving to me, David, and maybe you can put this into context, is the role that the new generation, that the younger folks, that the young people are playing in being a part of this resistance. You want to talk about that?
For sure. There have been marches and demonstrations from the moment that Trump really came into office with his, racist, statements about immigrants, with his threats, in which young people began coming out into the streets to protest. And especially what makes this especially important is that in a town like Santa Maria, but wasn't just in Santa Maria, I saw this in on the peninsula here in the Bay Area, San Carlos and Mountain View, where young people came out and organized marches in which they specifically said that we are marching for our parents. It is too frightening and too risky for them to come out themselves, and so we are going to come out for them. And so you had people, young people who were carrying signs that say, fighting for the ones that fought for us. That was really, moving to me, that just that sign. Or another one that I saw, it said, por mi papá, quien fue deportado, mírame de cielo, papito, esa es nuestra guerra, which means, for my father who was deported, watch me from heaven, father. This is the new war. So, people are coming out for their families, to protect their families. Young people are coming out to protect their families. And Trump is creating a whole new generation of activists, of people who are strong and know their rights and are willing to come out into the streets and defend their rights, and also just to defend their parents, their family members. So this is, I think, something that's, to me, another thing that's really hopeful about this situation, is that as terrifying as the raids are, that people are taking these steps.
Gavilan, I imagine this discussion is incredibly moving for you, and watch me from heaven, Father.
All of that, I consider myself an escapee, a survivor from the fields of misery, because I grew up here in California working those fields as a child. But thank you, David, for being with us today, and your work is just more important than ever, especially once you capture the images, they become immortal, and they have to resonate into the future. But you mentioned the young people, and one thing that I've seen is that we saw this incredible surgence of young people, young folks, undocumented, and those are the DACA students. They have been out there, since Obama, gave them, temporary, safety in the DACA, program. But those young people have become activists, organizers. And you mentioned Unión del Barrio, which is, it's been around for 3-4 decades, organizing around the area of Southern California, particularly around the borderlands. And you have the group out of Arizona, Puente. Again, these are kind of like youth groups that have decided, hey, my grandparents or my parents are vulnerable, I'm going to do this to protect not just them, protect our neighborhoods, protect the communities, and so forth. So there's a lot of hope in that. But one thing I know, David, and that's particularly in the San Joaquin and Central Valleys, and probably, to the coastal areas and off to Coachella, those areas are heavy, what we call, Bible Belt communities. The Republicans have an incredible stronghold. They bought up so much of the farmlands. You have very little, family-owned farms. Most of them have become corporate, farms, agricultural areas that they've taken control of. In that, Have you heard anything or sensed anything of a pushback from those, you know, because a lot of the donations that come to the Republican Party, to the MAGA Party, you know, come from Silicon Valley, and then you've got the, what I call the Bible Belt, the Central and San Joaquin Valleys, that donate, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands, if not millions, you know, to the GOP, to the MAGA Party. Have you heard anything or sensed anything of any kind of pushback from those groups? Because farm workers, as you know, David and Dennis, are essential to food production, from, you know, toiling the soil, cultivating, harvesting, you know, packing it, shipping it, delivering it, all of that. In every aspect of agriculture, you know, brown hands are involved. And have you heard again, has there been any outrage by the Republicans that, you know, control these valleys of food production?
I am so glad you asked that question, Miguel, because what you really hear is this incredible, deafening silence. So I know that you and anybody that's grown up in a farm worker town in California know about the cooperation between ICE and the growers. You know, this goes back way, 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 way back, where, for instance, you know, we wouldn't see any Border Patrol agents in the fields in Coachella until after the grape harvest was over. And then all of a sudden, when the workers weren't needed anymore, then you saw the vans, right? So this is kind of an old thing. And so I think that what we're seeing is something that's similar. Remember, you know, Trump himself said, like, what, a week and a half ago, that he wasn't going to conduct any raids because, you know, the workers were so essential, that lasted, what, a day. But in a way, you know, what he was saying, there was, you know, if we kind of look at it clearly, we can see certain things in there that are basic facts. Like, I look at strawberries, for instance, and strawberries is last year, $2.7 billion that was harvested by 55,000 people. That means that each worker harvested $50,000 worth of strawberries, for which workers got paid what? You know, the income of an undocumented family in the strawberries is about $13,000, $15,000 a year. So people are getting hardly any of that. So they are essential to the profit system here. And that has a lot to do with the way that the Trump administration is carrying out their raids. They do enough to terrorize people. And that also helps them because, for instance, we used to have little work stoppages at the beginning of the strawberry season along the coast where workers would try to push up the piece rate. And we don't see that right now because people are really afraid. They are afraid that if they do this, first of all, that the grower will call in the migra, which is, again, a kind of like an old tactic for dealing with unions and dealing with workers' protests. But also, because growers already have a substitute workforce that Trump has promised that he will make even more available to them. And that is the ability of growers to bring people to the U.S. under the H-2A visa program. And so in Santa Maria, about a third of all the strawberry workers in Santa Maria are already people who are being brought on this program. And so what it means, if you are a strawberry worker, if you're a family that lives in Santa Maria picking strawberries, you're not only worried about the migra, you're also worried about whether the grower is going to basically replace you in your job. And people were already telling me that they're only getting 4 or 5 hours of work a day, or maybe 3 or 4 days of work a week because of this kind of substitution. And actually, yesterday, the Trump administration got rid of the kind of meager protections that the Department of Labor put in place under Biden for those H-2A workers, you know, things that made, you know, wage theft, you know, not only illegal, but easier for workers to protest against, these kinds of just basic minimum worker protections. Well, Trump just wiped them away. And that is a direct favor to those growers. And I think that has to do with why we don't hear these massive protests from the growers. Where's the Western Growers Association, you know, in the newspapers, you know, railing and screaming about immigration raids and so forth? You don't hear it. And I think that's the reason.
Unbelievable. And, you know, the biggest fear that I have is they're going to, you know, start bringing in new technologies, you know, drones and so forth to go out in the areas and look how many workers and, you know, identify them through, you know, either face recognition or something. It's really frightening, you know. I've talked to some campesinos and they say, you know, I remember myself, David and Dennis, you know, when we used to call it La Migra, when the INS back then, you know, it was the INS. Today, it's ICE. Same bureaucracy. But I remember working out in the fields, and the airplanes would come. And as soon as we'd hear an airplane, everybody'd stop working. And everybody'd stand up, either we're picking grape or picking whatever fruit or vegetables. Everybody'd stop and look at the sky. And you could see that if, you know, it wasn't a plane coming in to spray. It was coming in to look at, see how many workers were out there. And within 20 minutes, 30 minutes, the trucks would come, you know, from the INS and start into the fields. And I mean, you know, grabbing people and, you know, creating perimeters and grabbing people as they ran into the woods or off into the rivers. But I remember that. And I remember being caught up in those running away. And today I flash back and I go, now they're not going to have these airplanes. They're going to have drones. You're not even going to hear them. They're going to come out there. Have you seen anything, heard anything around that, you know, using new technologies to assist ICE, and particularly in those rural areas?
Well, I'm sure that they have that kind of technology, because you go down to the border and you see how high-tech the border has become with all the surveillance down there, and I'm sure that they can employ exactly what you're talking about, Miguel, in terms of doing that. And again, it's also a terror thing. It's trying to make people afraid. You know, Tom Holman, the so-called immigration czar, bragged recently that this kind of terror had gotten a million people to self-deport, in other words, to leave the United States because they were afraid that they would get picked up in a raid. I think that is just complete, I don't know, we can't say these kinds of words on the radio here, but it is, yeah. You know, it is not true. It is a big, big, big lie. Because in reality, you know, I interviewed a young woman, I'm going to call her Emma to protect her identity, who talks about what happened after the Bakersfield raid right at the beginning of the Trump administration, where people were afraid to go to work. And for a couple of days, you know, there weren't any crews out picking oranges and, you know, in the orange fields in southern San Joaquin Valley. And so Emma said, you know, I didn't go to work for 2 days. I have a 5-year-old, and that's the fear that I wouldn't be able to come home to him. But on Wednesday, I went back to work. The fear is great, but the need is greater. And that just says so much to me, because what it says, first of all, is the fear in families. You know, I think one of the terrible, terrible things that has been forced on farm worker families is that parents have to give their kids training in what to do if they don't come home from work. You know, that Emma's five-year-old has already been told, you know, this is, you go and see the neighbor, you call your tio, your tia, you know, this is what you do if I don't come home. And that, you know, it just speaks to the, you know, way in which families are forced to cope with that fear and yet survive it. And then, you know, when she says, you know, the fear was great, but the need is greater. And what that means is that if you don't go to work, you can't pay the rent. You know, you have to go to work. You know, when called those farm workers essential, he wasn't paying them a compliment. What he was doing was, first of all, he was saying that the profits of the growers are essential, obviously, to him, but also that people have to be able to feed their families. They have to pay the rent. And these are the reasons why. That's why I think this whole thing about self-deportation, it's a danger for sure. And people, if people are being forced into it, then I think that's a terrible, terrible thing. But I think the reality of it also is that for most people go to work with the fear in their belly, the fear in their hearts, you know, wondering, like you say, Miguel, you know, the airplane close overhead or the drones come or you see the green van at the edge of the field and you wonder about whether your kid is going to have somebody to come home to.
Well, your photographs are extraordinary, David. We're speaking with David Bacon, longtime radical photographer in the fields, documenting the plight of the folks who do some of the hardest work in this country and only are being more abused than ever. I want to ask you, David, a technical question. You talked earlier about guarding the identity of somebody who you were telling us about, but you take photographs, so you can't guard the identity of the people in the field. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, I have to talk to people while I'm taking photographs, so this isn't something where you're kind of like doing something in a covert or a hidden way. You know, in a field of workers, actually, I think that this also speaks to something that's also true about farm workers, too. And is when I go into a field, first of all, I have to talk my way past the foreman because the foreman is the person that can tell me yes or no, whether I can take photographs there or not. So, you know, I have to kind of like talk my way past him. And then I have to go and explain to the workers who I am and what I'm doing there with the camera, white guy with the camera. You know, it could be a danger. It could not be, you know. And so the first thing is you sort of break the ice. So I'll usually say stuff like, well, you know, I'm here to take pictures and I'm here to take it for this project. And I'm only going to take pictures of the good looking people. So if you're not good looking, forget it. And so everybody will start to laugh and joke and say, well, don't take this picture or don't take that picture. And so it sort of helps people to relax a bit. But, you know, I try and make a quick explanation of what the purpose of the photographs are. You know, that we have a documentation project that's gone on for a long time about farm workers that is intended to show how difficult the work is and that it is essential work. And one thing I think that's really true about people who work in the fields, and that is people feel, how do you want to put it, underappreciated, let's put it that way, that people know that their work is essential for sure. And they also know that when consumers go into a supermarket and they pick up the head of lettuce or the box of strawberries, they don't have the faintest idea of what went into getting it there, what went into picking it. And so, yes. You know, we talk about that sometimes. You know, the purpose of these pictures is to show the reality so that people can really understand it and see it and appreciate what it is. And people feel validated by that in a way. People feel this is something that's important. We need to let the world know who we are and what it is that we do and the importance of it to the rest of the world. And so immigration status does play a role in that. And so I'm not going to ask people. I mean, I know what the reality is. I worked as an organizer for Farm Workers Union and other unions, too. I know what the reality of the workplace is and lots of people there who don't have papers. But I'm not interested in asking people about that. In fact, I think that's something that is a dangerous question because we're not, you know, in the photograph of a person working in the fields, people don't go around with a stamped on their foreheads, you know, I have papers or I don't have papers. A farm worker is a farm worker is a farm worker, a worker is a worker is a worker. And that's what the photographs are trying to show. And in reality, we know that as a statistical truth, that if you have, you know, 1,000 photographs of farm workers, which I have many more than that, you know, the Department of Labor itself says that half of the farm workers in the United States, half of the 2 million people who work in the fields don't have papers. So obviously some of those people don't have papers. But there's no way of tracing back through the photograph to the immigration status. Because it doesn't say that. It just says, you know, we're just looking at a person who is working in the fields. So, you know, that's kind of how I try and protect it. But it's also people have, you know, I ask people if I can take their picture. And Very rarely does somebody tell me no, but obviously if somebody doesn't want their picture taken, then we don't take their picture. And then sometimes also it's just a, you know, so if somebody is cutting lettuce in a field and I'm trying to take their picture, I'm walking backwards in the field with my camera down below at the ground level because I'm trying to show people's hands and what the work process is like and the face of the person and how difficult this is. And so I'm walking backwards and the worker is working towards me and people who cut lettuce are almost running while they're doing it. And so I'm sure that one of the things in the worker's mind is, you know, I wish this guy would get out of my way, you know, let me work. But people are very polite and, you know, generally speaking, people, you know, they feel that the process of documenting this work is an important one to them. And it's, I think that it is important. It's important to all of us that we know how the world works and we know the reality of where food comes from and who it is that's responsible for providing it.
And how all that wonderful food and protest that makes our table, produce that makes our tables beautiful, how that gets there, who does the work, what fingerprints are on it. David, we just have 2 minutes left. And so could you take a quick shot at the politics of this now? Would you say that farm workers are substantially worse off now under Trump at a different level of danger? What's your assessment being out there taking photographs, talking to people of how life has changed?
Well, I think that the big thing that has changed is, and we've been talking about this whole half hour, is the fear. People are having to live with the fear of getting picked up. And while that's been a constant long before Trump has really put this on steroids. And so that's been, that's made life a lot scarier. And also, I think that economically people are hurting more because of the H-2A problem, because of the fact that organizing the things that workers normally do to push the wages up has become much more dangerous. And so, you know, right now, you know, people get maybe, you know, 22 cents for picking the basket of strawberries that sells in the market for $5. You know, that tells you, you know, kind of like what their share in this industry is. But that 22 cents doesn't provide a decent living for anybody. And so I think that people are really feeling that kind of pain too, is the economic pain. And then people are angry. People are, you know, the racism of this system and the racism of Trump and the racism of the ICE agents and the growers and, you know, the local political authorities in towns like Santa Maria or Oxnard who, you know, make kind of nice speeches about things and then don't do anything. Yeah. I think all of that makes people feel like anger, you know, when is this going to change?
Thank you. We're out of time, but Miguel and I very much appreciate your work, David. Have for years appreciated your contribution, David Bacon. Marvelous photographer. Best way to see your stuff? 10 seconds?
Is, you know, look at, do a search for David Bacon, the reality check, and my respect for you and Miguel and the wonderful work you do too. Our
executive. Muchas gracias.
Si se puede, David.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?